I remember her saying, Jay, if you do this, do you know that you could possibly end up in hell? This is where I was, and this is for somebody. I was in so much pain, I didn't care where I ended up.
And that was the voice of Dr. Jay Barnett. Thank you so much for joining us for this edition of Conversations from Studio 5. Dr. Barnett is a former professional football player, but he's now focused on helping others. He is a licensed therapist, speaker, and author. He's talking today about mental health and his own struggle, as he knows firsthand what it means to contemplate suicide. Let's dive into the conversation.
So, I guess the basic question for me is, how do we go from football to therapy, if you will? Where does that transition for you in terms of your life? What happened?
I think the nexus to going from football to therapy was really the defining moments that I had overlooked the majority of my life.
Wow.
When my parents divorced at 13, as we were talking earlier, my father's been pastoring for pretty much most of my life. And when the divorce happened, for me, I had nothing to really to be supported by because I was the oldest, and so everyone was looking to me for support. Mm-hmm. And when everyone is looking to you for support, you only find support within. And for me, that support became football, became my coaches, my teammates. I come from a family of professional athletes, and cousins and uncles all play in the NFL. But it wasn't something that I was really pursuing until the divorce happened, because until then, I just wanted to be what my father was. He was a preacher. He was a great singer. He played, you know, phenomenal athlete. But the athlete part was, to me, at the bottom, and the preaching and the singing, those were things that I admired. Mm-hmm. And when that happened, I just, you know, did what I think every young black boy does when he doesn't have a father, mm-hmm. is you go to the closest, you know, place for you. And for me, it was, you know, the football field. For some guys, it's, you know, it's gangs. For some guys, it's the basketball court, it's the diamond, you know, baseball players. And not realizing that I was struggling with depression, mm-hmm. I was dealing with an attachment, you know, issue. And not necessarily saying that my issue was because of the divorce, but the detachment of that, my life has changed, mm-hmm. where I don't have this figure that I'm looking after, and I've become a figure that I'm now looking after my sisters and my mom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you take all of that and compile it game after game, hit after hit, and one day all of that stops, mm-hmm. and now you're having to look at your life over the past 8 years that you have suppressed your emotions, you suppress your feelings. I had suppressed everything, mm-hmm. because football was a great place to hide. As many of us do as men, we hide in places where no one would see us, mm-hmm. but also we're being seen in some capacity. Mm-hmm. And that's what that was for me. And it wasn't until after the second suicide attempt that I had that I really began to say, okay, I need to get some help. And getting help, you know, was not the easiest thing. You know, being a black man as a former athlete, you know, and says, hey, you know, I'm a football player, a guy with muscles, and a guy who's done great things. Like, you know, what are you doing in here? But the therapy was the catalyst that would really bring so many changes to my life, because at 30 years old, here I was sitting in this white man's office, and he asked me, how did I feel? And I had no clue of what that meant. No one had ever asked. A lot of people ask how I was doing, but not how I was feeling.
Yeah.
And if we know anything about doing, when we're asked, that it's always associated with performing or performance. You know, well, the wife is good, the kids are good, you know, bills are paid. But no, how are you feeling? What's going on inside? And man, I sat there in tears because I said, man, how do you get to 30 and you don't even know how you feel? And that's where it started for me. For the first time, I was able to pause because, man, I've been performing since 13. You know, I was a surrogate husband to my mother, you know, to my surrogate father, to my sisters. And, you know, everyone looked at me. And I didn't think twice about the cape I was wearing, even though the cape had holes in it.
Yeah.
And I couldn't fly. And I was emotionally paralyzed in some instances because I had never felt anything. And it wasn't until football was over that I felt everything. And
the hiding had to stop.
The hiding had to stop. Because there was no helmet that I could put on. Now I had to be seen every day. And I think the most terrifying thing for most men is for us to see ourselves. Mm-hmm. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And therapy is where I got to see not just myself, but I got to see the little boy that I was hiding and trying to protect.
So if you had to put a timeline on the road to where you felt like, okay, I've done enough work for me to now make my life dedicated to helping others free, what was that timeline or process like?
Probably about 10 years.
10 years.
Yeah, so I'm 41. I started therapy, right, 30, 31.
Mm-hmm.
It's about 10 years.
What was the rock bottom point? Was it, take me back to that moment. Was it the suicide attack?
Yeah, I think the rock bottom moment was, you know, being under the bed, you know, when my godmother came in the room.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'd been missing for all day.
Mm-hmm.
And I had taken, you know, so many pills, you know, I had a back injury from football, so I would often take Vicodin and, you know, and different things like that. And I had severe nerve damage, so I was taking these steroids here and there. And, you know, I could just reach down and bend my, you know, tie my shoe and my back would just go out. And then the nerve that was pinching on it was affecting, you know, everything. And I mean everything, like everything waist down. So, you know what I mean? For those that are watching, the soldiers was not marching.
Yes, I get you. Uh-huh.
So, and that was driving me into a deeper depression because here I am 30 years old and having issues, you know what I mean, from this severe nerve damage. So on one end, you're looking at football has provided me with so many great opportunities, but now I'm looking at the damage that football has caused. And the rock bottom moment was like, man, you was really, I mean, to this day, I don't know how I woke up and survived. Oh man, I took some every day. So I don't, my digestive system was messed up for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you are overdosing and your body's trying to break down, your liver is having an issue. I had so many issues having to go to the doctor and do different things to try to get my body reset.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that rock bottom moment was really a phone call with my parents.
Mm-hmm.
That night, I'm having a moment with them and I said to my dad, you know, and he says to me, here we go again. And that really was the trigger. And because I would have these moments and these, you know, episodes and my mom just said, you know, let's everybody be quiet. And I said, no, mom, I'm done. I said, I'm tired of this with him not listening and not seeing how I'm trying to shape all of the stuff that I saw as a kid, trying to shape not having this relationship with him and trying to please this man, I said, I'm done. And I remember her saying, Jay, if you do this, do you know that you could possibly end up in hell? This is where I was, and this is for somebody. I was in so much pain, I didn't care where I ended up. And that's what I said. I said, Mama, I don't care where I end up, just as long as I give her this pain. And when you think about suicide or suicidal ideation, as we call it in the clinical space, it's the thoughts of dying, it's the thoughts of taking your life, it's the thought of premeditating, setting the stage, all of those different things. And so for me, I lived with my godmother at the time, so I knew I couldn't shoot myself because I didn't want to leave a mess. So my only way out was to silently do something that wouldn't cause, because I was also conscious that I knew that she would find me, but how she would find me was what I was considering. Because I couldn't imagine her finding me with a gunshot wound to stain her floor. So all those things that I thought about. Because when we've studied individuals who have died by way of suicide, when you listen to the patterns of what they're saying and listen to their thoughts, it's very calculated. And when people says, well, I can't believe he did this. Like, oh, he's been thinking about this for a while. She's been thinking about that for a while. Today was just today. And that day became my day because of what my father said to me.
So that triggered the...
That triggered me. Yeah.
You shared the moment of therapy. How about the moment of conversation with God? Because obviously there's been a spiritual awakening for you as well since.
Yeah.
What happened?
So the conversation with God... I have this visitation where he comes in my room, and I'll never forget it. It was this overwhelming presence, and I remember him sitting on the bed with me, and he said, give this to me. And I'm literally in tears, and I'm like, why? Like, what are you going to do with it? And I said to him, I said, if I give this to you, what's going to happen? And he said, you got to trust me, Jay. And I'm in tears, and I'm just sitting there, and I mean, this presence is just so strong, I can't stop crying. And he says, I promise you, I will use all of it. He says that. He said, I promise you, I will use all of it. And later, in this conversation, man, because this is going on, it seems like forever, he says, if you attempt again, you will succeed. So he says, you have to make a choice. He said, there's a great purpose and a great call that I had on your life. And I just remember crying, saying, God, why me? Why all of this pain? Why? Like, you know, I mean, I'm looking at all my other siblings, they sleeping at night. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I just said, I don't have a choice. I do, but I don't. And something in me was so convinced that the promise sounds so much greater than the pain at that moment. Mm-hmm. Because that was also before I started this journey of doing the work. And I think so many times we as people, we're so infatuated with the promise and we forget there's a process. And trusting him was not easy because it was me saying, I have to surrender. And that took time because surrendering is not easy. And I decided, I'd never forget it, I decided, I said, God, I'm going to trust you. I'm going to give it to you. And that started that journey of that spiritual enlightenment, because I've walked with God since I was a kid. You know, I preached my first sermon at 9 years old, so I knew his voice. Mm-hmm. I knew who he was. Mm-hmm. My parents didn't coerce me into, you know, being like my dad. Mm-hmm. I knew there was a calling on my life. I knew it. But I did not know how that thing would manifest. You know what I mean? So I did not know that I would go through a Joseph period. I would go through a David period, to where how you are in the field and your father doesn't even really see you. You know what I mean? So I've gone through the abandonment, the rejection, and the looked over, and you know what I mean? And the other kids are, you know, praised, or they have the relationship, and the other kids are celebrated, and I'm kind of like, well, you'll be all right, you know. So that moment was similar to the same moment that Saul had on the road to Damascus. And it was a light that I have never to this day, man, I think about it. I know probably once a week, because I'm looking at where he has me at now in this position, traveling around the country and this and that. And I remember one day sitting at my desk after I finished some homework, and I said, "You knew all along." And he said, "If I didn't think that you couldn't do it, I would have never chose you." And I think that's the hardest thing for us as people, is to accept that his plan is so much greater than what we had in mind. Yeah. And I remember him vividly. I vividly remember him saying, "Your purpose is going to take you places football could have never taken you." And it's so it's a overwhelming testimony, man.
When it comes to talking about mental health, and doing the work that you've done and that you're continuing to help others do, what advice would you give, especially to Black men, with dealing with our stuff?
Yeah.
Why is this important?
Yeah, it's important for us as Black men because we've never been given the space. The way we've been socialized, not only just through society, not only just through the system, we have been wired to think that we don't have feelings. We've been bred to feel that, you know, we're just machines. I mean, you take it all the way back to slavery. I mean, you look at, you know, the different systems that were put in place. They looked at us physically. They looked at us, you know, how we stood in our stature. You know, can you make another strong baby? Can you create a lineage of other kids that can go out and work in the fields? That's not somebody who is considerate of your psychological state. That is someone who's only concerned about how you are physically able to perform. So historically, as Black men, there hasn't been anything in place that has focused on our mental and psychological, emotional well-being. So you take generations after generation after generation after generation, and you look at our grandfathers, who was just, "Granddad, I love you." "Yeah, you too." And you think about these men who were led to believe that being stoic was what a man was about, that you couldn't cry. Matter of fact, you better not cry, because if you did, I don't know how much of a man are you. So you take all of these different social messages and these societal messages, and then you place this Black man in a marriage and says, "Terry, tell me how you feel." He doesn't know. So, and I wanted to provide that contextually so I can help brothers to understand that it's okay that you don't know, but it's not okay that you continue to not know. So you are a being. We have focused so much on humans doing and not being.
Yeah.
And what I'm wanting brothers to focus on is just being. Who are you outside of what you do? And you can't discover that until you sit with yourself. It's okay to acknowledge that something is hurting you. It's okay to acknowledge that something embarrassed you, that something disappointed you, that something discouraged you. And the more that we avoid what we feel, the farther away we get away from what we feel. And I think that it's important for black men to understand that your feelings matter. It's not an indictment on your masculinity. It's not a question about your sexuality and the intersection of how you see yourself at work versus on who you are. It's multidimensional. And so I think it's important for brothers just to understand that, man, you matter. Suicide rate is climbing daily amongst black men and black boys. And I remember I grew up in the South. It was considered, this is a white folks thing. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, oh, white people off themselves. Like, and now all of a sudden, you have black men that say, I'm tired. I'm tired of performing. I'm tired of living. I'm tired of fighting the man. And then fighting myself. Mm-hmm. And then having to come home to a family who just says, can we have your ATM card? It's like, you know what I mean? So it's like, and when I speak about mental health, I try to stay away from the terminology of what we talk in the clinical, but just to talk about life is mental health. Yeah. It's your emotional state. It's how you get in your car. What is the first thing you do? Do you turn the radio on? You know, I know for me, I sit. Mental health is how you behave. How do you show up in your social circles? And so it's important because I think the more men are seeing myself and saying, wow, this guy went from this barbaric, because I was, you know, I was a dog on that field. So, you know what I mean? But to also to see somebody go through this metamorphosis of evolving into a whole man, meaning that nothing has changed. I've just changed how I see myself. Yeah. I'm more than just putting on pads and a helmet and being, you know, strong and being able to run through somebody. Like, no, I'm able to say, that hurts. And doesn't mean I'm going to tear this stuff down. It just means that I'm acknowledging what I feel. So I'm not projecting anything onto you. And so it's just you know, when you talk about mental health, man, it's so layered. And what I always tell people when they bring me in to speak, give me time to walk these guys. Because if you take a guy who, I had a guy 60 years old in therapy. He says, man, I can't remember. He said, I hadn't cried since I was like 10. You imagine 50 years and you haven't cried? And you, somebody, you know, walks you into therapy and you're just kind of like, I don't know how to do this. And so it's important that we continue to not only just have conversation, but black men like us are seen. Yeah. And especially when it comes into the media space where you see a man that his masculinity is not in the stature, his masculinity is how he responds. Yeah. I've never looked at a man and said, oh, he looks strong. Like, no, strength doesn't have a look to it. In fact, strength is in the very essence of how do you deal with life happenings? Do you run? Do you stand? Do you sit? Do you avoid? Do you deflect? Mental health. So that's why it's important for me to expound, you know, and God was so unique with choosing me because I have the experiential along with the clinical and along with the education. But much of what I've learned has been revelation as well. Because there's some things that I see that I learn in a book.
Yeah. I understand. Yeah. For someone watching who is wondering practically, okay, I'm hearing you and I know I got to do something. How do they begin to navigate the steps of, okay, I've never been to therapy. I don't even know what a therapist is. Where do I begin this process of getting the help I need?
Yeah. So before I get into steps, I do want to say this for the men that are watching. My book, Just Heal Bro, which is a journal, is a phenomenal start. Here's why it's a start. For most brothers, we don't have the language. And we don't have the language because we don't have the vocabulary. It's hard to learn Spanish if you don't understand the vocabularies, right? You don't understand the alphabets and those things. And so that book is such a great starter because the prompts and the questions help men to kind of write down and to kind of begin. And I say that because for most men, it's this, it's an ego thing, because no man wants to do something that he know he can't do, right? You know what I mean? It's like, yeah, if I'm not good at it, I don't know, I don't want it. Because, you know what I mean? And again, it takes time to kill the ego and to be vulnerable enough and say, I don't know. So that book is a great start for brothers, because I don't push therapy to men. What I do is I encourage healing. And healing looks different for everyone. So step one would be identifying where it hurts. Even a doctor asks you, where does it hurt? And for brothers, it's important to identify, man, what's going on? You know, I haven't been motivated in years, man. I'm just going to work. Me and my wife, we just going through the motions. Where does it hurt means that, man, I went after a job, bro, and I didn't get it. That's where it hurts. And ever since that happened, you have been disconnected from everything because of what? Disappointment. And that's the emotion. So step one is identifying where it hurts. Identifying where you can see where the changes begin or where the change happened. Number two is finding a space where you can begin to talk, process what is hurting. And that may be with a counselor, that may be with a coach, and that may be somebody that you already have that you trust. And I love to encourage brothers, it start with individuals that have already earned your trust. Because we're not open up to people that we don't trust. We're not like women, you know. Women folks, I love y'all, but y'all gonna open up wherever. Mm-hmm. Wherever somebody will listen. Yeah. Brothers don't do that.
No.
Because brothers...
Barbershops and beauty salons are quite different.
Very different. Because a brother gonna sit there and find out what you own before he start talking. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So, and then number three, I would say giving yourself permission to begin to explore, feel, giving yourself permission to begin to visit those places, because there's so many men that have put so many experiences in the back of their mind that like, I'm not going there ever again. I'm not bringing it up. It happened. And, you know, I don't want to acknowledge that that happened. So number one, identifying. Number two is find a trusted space with somebody that has already earned your trust. Mm-hmm. And number three, giving yourself the permission to explore, permission to feel. And those are the three steps that I think that can begin. Now, if those three steps lead you to therapy, great. But these are three steps that you can start on your own. And to the brothers that are watching, you have to sit still. You can't heal and move in movement. You have to sit still. So your soul, your body, and your spirit can all come in alignment to begin to deal with those things, you know. So that's what I would say. And trying to simplify it as much as I possibly can, but yeah.
Beautiful. Personally, if you could go back in time and look in the mirror and see that young Jay, knowing that you would have two suicide attempts, that you would see parents divorced, that you would have gone through all that you've gone through, what advice would you tell him if you could?
Man, well, you hit deep with that one. Man. Man, I don't know what I would say to that kid. You know, when you're a kid, man, you just, you know, your mind goes everywhere, but it goes to the best of places. And I guess what the word that I would hear to tell that kid is just be ready to endure. That's what I would tell them, be ready to endure. Because the uncertainties of life and life happiness, it's just like, man, you just, you know, that's, this is something I've never shared, man. There's times I wake up in the middle of the night and I think I'm a kid and I'm looking for my parents. It's like I wake up and I'm in the house and it's like the little version of me. It's just kind of like, I'm still thinking my parents are together, and I'm just like, I had this dream. I never forget in therapy having to work through this part and having to, and they was talking about what was happening with my subconscious state. But it's, you know, and at 41 years old, I'm just like, well, you know, what's going on? It's like, I'm, you know, healed in those areas. But the mind still goes back to try to recover, recapture. And so that's what I would tell him, is be ready to endure, man. You know, and then that he is enough. You know, I never felt that I was enough. You know, so I would definitely tell him that, to understand that he's enough early on. That way he's not seeking out validation. You know.
You and your dad had a tough conversation.
You know, it's funny you ask that, because Charlamagne asked me the same thing. You know, we were, I just saw him for Thanksgiving, man, and it's, we watched the Tyler Perry documentary, which was very powerful. Mm-hmm. And I watched his body language, because my story mirrors a lot of what Tyler went through. And he didn't say much. You know, my whole family was watching it, and you know, everybody knows what I endured. And I've had to accept that he doesn't know what to say. So I've written him letters to let him know that I forgive him, to let him know that I've moved on, and I call him. But he won't go deep. You know what I mean? And so he won't have those tough conversations. Not with me, I'm being his only son, like not with me. Like he, I think he touched it to surface a little bit with my sisters, mm-hmm. but not with me. And I said this on a podcast probably a month ago, and I said, you know, as I learned more about him, what I realized is that he was a father still longing to be a son. And just this weekend, transparently, my sister said, yeah, we was talking to her aunt, and she was telling us how much granddaddy hated dad. You know? So even that, you know, kind of, you know, hit me, you know what I mean? So it's like, I can't fault him for how he's handled and his inability to connect, because he's probably been trying to find himself. And then he doesn't receive the appreciation and the admiration until my grandfather's on his deathbed. And then I begin to think of my sister, says, I feel like you're not going to hear what you need to hear until he's on his deathbed. Which is unfortunate, you know, because I think a father passing should be a time of blessings for the children, right? Because there's so many emotions, you know what I mean? And so my sister said that, and that's been sitting with me for the past 2 or 3 days. And but also what's sitting with me is, are you okay with that? That if you don't get what you're really looking for, because knows he's, you know, he's saying he's proud of me. He's always, he's doing those things now. But it's like, I even, you know, sitting in the house, like, he won't say anything. I'm saying to myself, dude, just say it. Mm-hmm. What do you see? And he said something to the family. He says, I've always saw Jay to be, man, I saw him when he was a kid. Like, I knew he was going to be something special. But then it just stops. And I'm saying, what did you see? You know what I mean? So there's no hard, no tough conversation. I have just learned to accept him as he is and not what I want him to be. And that gives me great peace, man. Yeah. And that's how I know that I've healed in that area.
Dr. Jay Barnett is the author of several books, including Hello King. You can purchase his book wherever you get your reading material. Thank you so much for joining us for this edition of Conversations from Studio 5. And thank you for making Dish your weekly destination for uplifting interviews that tie the worlds of pop culture, entertainment, and faith. Hope you'll come back next week. Next week, we're sitting down for a conversation with the trio of singing siblings called Cain. You don't want to miss them. For more information on this show, please be sure to check out our Facebook page. You can also find us on Instagram simply by searching Studio 5. We'll see you next time right here on the podcast.